quest for immortality, quite another to enforce it with sanctions. The Arian Controversy. A year after Constantine wrote this letter in 324 CE, another ecclesiastical crisis came to a head. This one involved a dispute of theological importance. At least it seemed important to the participants at the time, as it has to theologians in the centuries since. But to Constantine and many others till today who have stood outside the ranks of the professional theologian, it seemed picayune and immaterial. This was the famous Arian controversy, a dispute that had arisen in Alexandria, Egypt, between a priest in the church named Arius and his bishop, Alexander. There had been heated debates for generations among Christian theologians over the true nature of Christ. From almost the beginning, Christians had maintained that Christ was not just a human, even though for most theologians he was certainly that, but also the Son of God. In fact, already in our earliest Christian author, Paul, Christ was understood to be a divine being who existed in the heavenly realm prior to his birth, Philippians chapter 2, verses 6 through 8. In some sense, he was God, but in what sense? This was an issue that had never been satisfactorily resolved, in no small part because most Christians had always wanted to affirm with vigor four different propositions that, at least on the surface, appeared to create a contradiction. Christ is God, God the Father is God, Christ is not God the Father, and there is only one God. So if Christ is God and God is God, how is it that Christians can say there is only one God? In short, how can Christians be monotheists? It all hinges on what it means to say that there is only one God, and on how the Son of God is understood to relate to the Father. It is on these issues that Arius disagreed with his bishop, Alexander. Arius held a view in wide circulation among Christians for a long time, even if no one had articulated it with the same clarity and force. Christ for him was certainly a divine being, the Logos, the Greek word for word, of God, and he certainly existed before he came into the world as Jesus Christ. Moreover, he was the agent of all creation. As the Gospel of John affirms, it was through the Logos that God created the heavens and the earth, John chapter 1, verses 1 through 3. So he was divine, but he was separate from God. Then how do the two relate to each other? Arius maintained that Christ, the Logos, could not be equal with God the Father. The Father himself is almighty. There cannot be two beings who are both almighty, since then neither of them is almighty. For Arius, only God the Father is almighty. Originally, in eternity past, God existed alone by himself. He then, prior to the creation of the universe, begot a son, a second divine being, who, since he was begotten of God, was secondary and subservient to him, as a son is to a father. This was the Logos, through whom the world was made, and who much later took on human form and came into the world in order to bring salvation. The Logos, then, is a subordinate divinity, who was brought into being at some point. He had not always existed. God the Father is superior to God the Son by an infinity of glories. Arius's bishop Alexander could not disagree more. He took a hard line that Christ was not subservient to God the Father as a subordinate being. Christ himself had said, "I and the Father are one, and if you have seen me, you have seen the Father." John chapter 10, verses 30, chapter 14, verse 9. The two are equal. They are not identical, to be sure. The Son is a separate being from the Father, but they are equally omnipotent and have both existed forever. There never was a time that the Logos did not exist. Those taking Alexander's side in the debate could point out that, by definition, if something is perfect, it can never change. If something changes, necessarily it becomes either better or worse from the change. But if it becomes better, it was not perfect before, and if it becomes worse, it is not perfect after. Since God is perfect, he can never change. That means he could not become the Father by begetting a son, since this would involve a change in his status from not Father to Father. Necessarily, then, God has always been the Father. If he was always the Father, then the Son must always have existed. Thus, Alexander's side of the debate maintained that the Son was co-eternal with the Father and all-powerful along with him. He was not merely like the Father of a similar kind of divine substance. he was equal with the Father, of the same substance. In the Greek terms used in these debates, the idea of being of the same substance is expressed by the word homoousios. By contrast, the word for similar substance is homoiousios. As you can hear, they are very similar words, different only with the letter I, or in Greek, the iota in the middle. Some observers have noted that the theological controversy threatening to fracture the church was a debate over an iota. That is certainly what Constantine personally thought. Because the dispute was causing such turbulence, he felt compelled to intervene, and did so first by writing the two principles a letter. In it, he clearly states his ultimate concern, which had never been about theological niceties, but about unity. My first concern was that the attitude towards the divinity of all the provinces should be united in one consistent view. Constantine did not care which view emerged from the debate. He simply wanted one side to concede to the other, and thereby effect unity. Personally, he indicated that he considered the matter extremely trivial and quite unworthy of so much controversy. For him, these were small and utterly unimportant matters involving a very silly question. He urged Alexander and Arius to settle the matter between themselves. They were unable to do so. It was not simply that they were at odds with each other. Both sides had numerous supporters who engaged in vitriolic attacks on the theological ignorance of the other. The debate was racking the church. Constantine decided to intervene in a major way by calling for the first worldwide or ecumenical council of bishops to meet and resolve the issue. This was the famous Council of Nicaea in 325 CE, named after the city in Asia Minor where the meeting was held. Later records indicate that some 318 bishops from around the world came to participate, most of them from the eastern provinces. As we have seen, the church was not nearly as well established in the West. Constantine himself attended the meeting. He gave the opening address and participated in the discussions. At the end, the bishops took a vote. Arius lost. The council devised a creed, a statement of faith that expressed its understanding of the nature of both the Father and the Son, and related important theological matters. Included in the creed were a number of anathemas or curses on anyone who took a contrary position. That creed ultimately came to form the basis of the Nicene Creed still recited in many churches today. At the council, only 20 participants ended up on the Arian side. Constantine pressured the naysayers to concede the case, and convinced nearly all of them to do so. The only two recalcitrant bishops, along with Arius himself, were sent into exile. As was true of the Donatist controversy, the council called by Constantine did not finally resolve the matter. Arians continued to press their case and made converts to their cause. Emperors after Constantine, including his own offspring, adopted the Arian view and exercised their authority to cement its stature in the church, even though, as we will see, it eventually lost. Our concern here, however, is with Constantine himself and his relation to the Christian faith. By 325 CE, he had learned more about the intricacies of Christian theological discourse than he ever expected. He wanted unity, but he was not willing to impose it by sending troops to deconvert the Arians by the sword. When it came to matters of the church, he believed in persuasion. In terms of civil governance, on the other hand, he remained very much a military man, quite willing to lead the armed and dangerous forces himself when it was to his political advantage. Constantine's military and political activities. By 313 CE, Constantine and Licinius had reached a temporarily amicable decision to co-rule the empire. Diocletian's brainchild, the Tetrarchy, was a thing of the past. One might think the two-emperor solution imposed by the resolution of the civil wars would prove practicable. Constantine would rule the West and Licinius the East. It was not to work out that way in the long run, however, in no small measure, because Constantine was a man never satisfied. He knew how to wait for what he wanted, but ultimately he was driven by massive ambition. From early he had set his sights on being the sole ruler, the first since the early days of Diocletian's reign some four decades earlier. The next decade saw the rise of antagonism with Licinius and occasional military flare-ups as relations frayed. According to Eusebius, the final straw came in 324 CE with Licinius's decision to renew the persecution of Christians in the East. This was all the excuse Constantine needed. In fact, some modern scholars think it is an excuse he himself manufactured for the occasion. Constantine chose to move against his co-emperor and rescue his co-religionists. He defeated Licinius in a major battle, sent him to retirement in Thessalonica, and eventually ordered his death. Constantine was now in complete control. Not everyone was joyful at the prospect. When Constantine traveled to Rome to celebrate his 20th anniversary as emperor in 326 CE, he chose not to follow the centuries-old custom of making a token sacrifice to Jupiter upon entering the city as conqueror. That decision has always made perfect sense to Christian commentators, but it proved disastrous for imperial public relations, incensing pagan members of the Roman Senate. Constantine's ties with the ruling elite soured. He had already, by this time, begun building a new capital city for the empire, a kind of new Rome that he named after himself. Constantinople, that is, Constantine's city, now modern Istanbul. He was to spend much of his final years in residence there, never again even visiting Rome. For the new capital, he chose a strategically important location, something that Rome itself obviously never had, the city of Byzantium on the Bosphorus Strait. From there, it would be much easier to oversee troop movements, both east and west, and the site itself was relatively easy to defend and difficult to assault. Constantine had Byzantium destroyed, and then he carried out a carefully conceived architectural plan for its replacement. He built his capital as an explicitly Christian city. There were to be no temples to pagan divinities, and no sacred idols, with one exception. In order to adorn his city with statuary, a typical feature of the ancient urban environment, Constantine had sacred sites from around his empire pillaged, with bronze statues brought back and installed in public spaces throughout the city. This decision had a triple function. It deprived pagan religions of their revered cult images. It desacralized the statues and made them secular objects of art, and it raised the aesthetic appeal of his new capital. In the process, it gave the opportunity for Christians, whether resident or visiting, to mock the religious views of pagans. In Eusebius's Life of Constantine, we are told that the emperor used these very toys, that is, the pagan playthings, their idols, for the laughter and amusement of the spectators. If Eusebius is right, we can assume the despoiled pagans were not amused. Acts such as this and the attendant mockery foreshadowed much worse things yet in store for devotees of traditional pagan religions. This was not the end of the mischief, however. Constantine also stripped the doors and roofs off temples throughout the empire. He had other uses for the fine metal, so too with cult statues plated with gold. He sent several members of his inner circle on a destructive campaign to every province of his reign to go city by city, country by country, and order the consecrated officials themselves to bring out their gods with much mockery and contempt from their dark recesses into daylight. They then had the gold plate stripped off and melted down for other uses. After denuding the statues, they left the superfluous and useless remnants to the superstitious to keep as a souvenir of their shame. How the tide had turned! Now it was not the Christians who were superstitious, it was the pagans. It was not the Christians who embraced a religion open to public mockery, it was the pagans. It was not the Christians who suffered from the imperially sponsored violence, it was the pagans. The tide would continue to turn against the pagans in years to come, and it would never turn back, except for one brief moment under the reign of the Emperor Julian. Constantine thus built his city and adorned it with the spoils of the pagan empire. It was a city built to last. It remained the capital of Christendom for over a millennium, until the assault of the Ottoman Turks in 1453. Constantine as an advocate for the faith. There should no longer be any doubt about the sincerity of Constantine's devotion to the God of the Christians, despite the incredulity of some scholars over the years. Of course, it is technically possible that it was all a front, but his deep and personal commitment to Christian causes, if nothing else, should lay all suspicions to rest, as should his own words, found repeatedly throughout the sources, as in a letter he sent to those living in Palestine. Indeed, my whole soul, and whatever breath I draw, and whatever goes on in the depths of the mind, that, I am firmly convinced, is owed by us wholly to the greatest God. Not only did Constantine take a vital interest in internal Christian affairs, he also took considerable steps to improve the lot of the church and the clergy who ran it. Most of the staffing and funding of ancient urban societies came from local aristocracies, not through high taxes, but through enormous demands placed on their time, energy, and resources. Public office was an oft-noted burden for the wealthy, involving considerable outlays of cash, not just expected, but demanded for public buildings and public services. These official positions did provide real status for its occupants, but the large outlays of personal resources could obviously have been put to other more personal uses. Constantine issued legislation that absolved Christian clergy, who by this time tended to be among the local aristocracies, from having to serve in civic capacities, relieving them of such duties and financial obligations. Moreover, he provided them with extensive funds out of the imperial treasury for use in their congregations. Most famously, Constantine himself arranged for the building of major churches throughout his empire, including the Lateran in Rome. In some instances, he had these churches constructed on sites that had previously boasted famous and important pagan shrines. That required, of course, the destruction of temples. As Eusebius reports with approbation in his Life of Constantine, Constantine took shrines that pagan priests had splendidly adorned and stripped them bare so that he completely destroyed temples that had been most highly prized by the superstitious. It has sometimes been thought, based on this passage, that Constantine went on an empire-wide rampage, but Eusebius can specify only 5 sites that suffered this fate, 3 of them involving the worship of Aphrodite, 1 connected with the famous opponent of Jesus, Apollonius of Tyana, and another on the sacred site of Mamre, a place that was to be revered because it was connected with the Jewish patriarch Abraham in the Old Testament. See Genesis chapter 18. One of the temples of Aphrodite was also located on holy ground, the place of Jesus' passion. The temples of Aphrodite were suspected as places of sacred prostitution, providing Constantine all the excuse he needed to send in the wrecking crews. Thus Constantine may have had good reasons for these particular destructions. They do not, however, indicate a trend. As one recent scholar has observed, there is no reason to generalize from these cases to an empire-wide policy of temple destruction. Still, once more, we see a foreshadowing of things to come. The religious zeal behind these demolition and building projects can be seen in Eusebius's account of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. It is sometimes thought that Constantine's mother, Helena, herself very Christian by this time, instigated the building of the church, but that is almost certainly not the case. Eusebius indicates that Constantine himself decided that he ought to make universally famous and revered the most blessed site in Jerusalem of the Savior's resurrection. Unfortunately, there was already a shrine on the spot, and not just any shrine, but an unholy, vile, pagan shrine built by wicked men who had been driven by demons to cover over the place where Jesus had been buried. They had brought in dirt from elsewhere and covered up the whole place, then leveled it, paved it, and so hid the divine cave somewhere down beneath a great quantity of soil. Above it, they had built a terrible tomb of their own for dead idols. It was a gloomy sanctuary to the impure demon of Aphrodite. There they offered foul sacrifices upon defiled and polluted altars. Constantine's solution? A demolition and refurbishing of the site. The shrine was torn down and destroyed, the place dug up, and the cave where Jesus had been buried uncovered. On the spot Constantine had built a magnificent structure in honor of the Savior, at the site still visited by millions of pilgrims and tourists to this day. Helena is not said to have had any hand in the affair, but she was active as a Christian ambassador in other ways. She is indeed most famous for her pious journey as a septuagenarian to the Holy Land, back in the days when it had never occurred to the faithful of Christendom to walk where Jesus walked. But she did so, and brought with her funding from the imperial treasury to recapture the place for Christ. It is not true that Helena claimed to have discovered the wood of the true cross. That is the stuff of later legend. Eusebius, who discusses key events of her visit, says nothing of the sort, but Helena did choose two auspicious sites for special church buildings. One, the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, where Jesus was believed to have been born. The other, the Church of the Ascension, just outside Jerusalem on the Mount of Olives, the site of his being taken up into heaven after his resurrection. In these projects, needless to say, Helena had the full backing of her avid Christian son. In contrast to those scholars who have argued that if Constantine were a real Christian, he would have been even more avid, some modern experts have argued that Constantine was so thoroughly committed to the Christian cause that his ultimate goal was to convert the entire empire. However, that is almost certainly not the case. Even if he himself was firmly committed to the Christian God, Constantine had imperial reasons for not forcing the issue or compelling his subjects. He had seen well enough what would come of coercion. He had lived through the Great Persecution, observing it up close as a member of the courts of both Diocletian and Galerius. It did not work. Constantine obviously was heavy-handed when he felt a need to be, as with the bishops of Nicaea. He was not, however, inclined to compel the religious preferences or even practices of his predominantly pagan empire. In the next chapter, we will see that some of Constantine's successors did not share his commitment to tolerance. By the end of the 4th century, serious legislation issued from the imperial throne banning pagan practices altogether on pain of severe judicial penalty. One particularly thorny historical question involves Constantine's tolerance of traditional cultic practices, or his lack of it. Did he try to shut down pagan religious activities by criminalizing animal sacrifice? There is no doubt about his personal views. He despised animal sacrifice, the blood, the gore, the stench, and in fact the entire practice. He repeatedly said so. The historical issue is whether this is one instance in which he forced his views on all others by disallowing sacrifice throughout his empire. Some prominent experts have claimed he did, and in support, they can cite some important evidence. For one thing, this is explicitly what his biographer Eusebius states. According to the life of Constantine, after defeating Licinius in 324 CE, Constantine passed a law that restricted the pollutions of idolatry, which had for a long time been practiced in every city and country district, so that no one should presume to set up cult objects, or practice divination or other occult arts, or even to sacrifice at all. Later Eusebius indicates again that by imperial injunction, for all those under Roman rule, both civilian and military, access was universally blocked to every form of idolatry and every form of sacrifice banned. Moreover, in successive laws and ordinances, he prohibited everyone from sacrificing to idols, from practicing divination, and from having cult figures erected. One cannot underestimate how significant such legislation would be. If the rates of growth and figures provided in Chapter 6 are relatively correct, by 325 CE, there would have been something like 5 million Christians in the empire. If there were also some 4 million Jews, we might round up and say that of the 60 million inhabitants of the empire, 50 million were still pagans practicing their traditional cults. Did Constantine bring the worship of 5/6 of his empire to a crashing halt? If so, would other sources have failed to mention some such little incident? One other reference does seem to confirm the act. It comes in a law passed in 341 CE, 4 years after Constantine's death, by his emperor son Constantius, who clearly did indeed attempt to abolish pagan sacrificial practices. Here's what the law said, according to the latter compilation of legal injunctions made early in the 5th century known as the Theodosian Code. Superstition shall cease. The madness of sacrifices shall be abolished. For if anyone in violation of the law of the sainted emperor our father, and in violation of this command of our clemency, should dare to perform sacrifices, he shall suffer the infliction of a suitable punishment, and the effect of an immediate sentence. We have already seen that it was far easier in the Roman Empire to issue legislation than to enforce it, and the enforcement even of this explicit condemnation of pagan sacrifice appears to have been lax indeed, virtually non-existent. It was another 50 years, and millions more Christian conversions later, before anti-pagan legislation took any serious hold. But for our purposes, the important point is that Constantius II in 341 CE indicates that his father had already ordered a cessation of sacrifice. That coincides with what Eusebius claimed just 2 years earlier in the publication of His Life of Constantine. Are these two Christian sources, one an imperial biographer and the other an actual emperor, to be trusted? It has proved to be one of the most hotly debated issues of Constantine's religious activities. On one hand, this is because there is no hard evidence of any such law. Eusebius, who claims it existed, never cites it, either in his Life of Constantine or in his church history, in both of which he was more than a little eager to celebrate the triumph of the church over the evils of paganism, and especially to trumpet the victories of the faith over the powers of darkness achieved by the Emperor Constantine. Why would he not cite the actual law if he had something to cite? Moreover, there is no such law in the Theodosian Code. This was a collection of legislation made by legal scholars under the reign of Theodosius II, published in 438 CE. It is a very large book containing laws passed by emperors, starting with Constantine himself in 313 CE and continuing for the next 125 years. The laws are arranged topically and represent, to be sure, only a selection of legislation. The compilers had to choose what to include and what not to. But the final book of the Code is devoted to important laws connected with religion, almost exclusively related in one way or another to Christianity, of course. And there is a section of the book that focuses on legislation against pagan practices. No law of Constantine is cited forbidding sacrifice. The case against such legislation is even stronger than that. We have the direct testimony of the famous Roman rhetorician Libanius, a major figure in Roman imperial life toward the end of the 4th century. Libanius was an avid pagan and advocate of traditional religions. Living during the reign of the uber-Christian Theodosius I, he felt the pressure from the empire on his personal commitments and issued a plea for religious tolerance in the face of imperial legislation against pagan practices. In the course of his eloquent oration, Libanius urges the precedent of Constantine himself for toleration, reminding the emperor that Constantine made absolutely no alteration in the traditional forms of worship. That would have been a very foolish argument to make if there was any solid evidence that, in fact, Constantine had shut down or tried to shut down the entire apparatus of pagan worship. How, then, can we explain all the evidence, some that says he did, or attempted to, outlaw sacrifice, and other that indicates he did not? Numerous solutions have been proposed over the years, including attempts to reconcile the statements in various sources so that both Eusebius is right that Constantine passed such a law and Libanius is right that he did not. Most of these reconciliations are a bit forced, however, and possibly it is best to adjudicate the matter by considering what Constantine himself says about it in the letter that he directed to inhabitants of the eastern provinces in 324 CE. Here, Constantine states directly that the doctrines of the divine word, that is, the tenets of the Christian faith, are held firmly by those who think aright and are concerned with genuine merit. It simply cannot be helped, he indicates, if non-Christians refuse to come to the truth for salvation. If any prevents himself from being cured, let him not blame it on someone else, for the healing power of medicines is set out, spread openly to all. Here, Constantine intimates a doctrine of tolerance for those foolish enough to refuse the healing salve provided by Christ. But he goes on to insist explicitly on toleration for those who choose to continue practicing pagan cults. Let no one use what he has received by inner conviction as a means to harm his neighbor. What each has seen and understood, he must use, if possible, to help the other. But if that is impossible, the matter should be dropped. It is one thing to take on willingly the contest for immortality, quite another to enforce it with sanctions. Constantine clearly and directly opposes the use of sanctions to enforce religious practices on those who are unwilling, or to disallow practices. His own comments show that Harold Drake, a leading expert on the reign of Constantine, is probably right. Constantine opted for persuasion, not coercion. Constantine, the imperious emperor. That should not be taken to mean that Constantine was soft in his rule of the empire. Roman social historian Ramsay MacMullan has raised the question of what practical difference it made to the empire that the emperor became Christian. Working through the legislation found in the Theodosian Code, one finds penalties enacted by Constantine that reveal clearly his judicial savagery. It is true that most of these laws were meant to promote social decency and to advance basic principles of morality, but the punishments? Imperial bureaucrats who accepted bribes were to have their hands cut off. Ineffective guardians of girls who had been seduced were to have molten lead poured down their throats. Tax collectors who treated women tax delinquents rudely were to be done to death with exquisite tortures. Anyone who served as an informer was to be strangled, and the tongue of envy cut off from its roots, plucked out. Slaves who informed on their masters were to be crucified. Anyone guilty of parricide shall not be subjected to the sword or to fire or to any other customary penalty, but he shall be sewed in a leather sack and confined within its deadly closeness. He shall share the companionship of serpents and then thrown into a river or ocean, so that while still alive he may begin to lose the enjoyment of all the elements. How is one to account for such judicial cruelty from a Christian emperor? McMullen suggests that by the 4th century Christianity was revealing an increasingly cruel streak. He notes in particular the heightened popularity of the Christian literature we previously considered that delights in recounting in graphic detail the torments of hell for those who refuse to do God's will. Possibly what applied to heaven applied to earth. If this is how God handles sin, then who are we to act differently? As McMullen puts it, religious beliefs may have made judicial punishment specially aggressive, harsh, and ruthless. In a similar vein, McMullen also stressed one of the key differences between Christianity and traditional pagan religions that we too have already seen, the centrality of religious ethics. True, pagans were as a rule no more or less ethical than Christians. But in pagan circles, ethical teachings fell under the province of philosophy, not religion, with rare exceptions, such as cases of parricide. For that reason, pagan cults did not take a stand on matters of daily behavior or misbehavior. Not so Christianity. And that, McMullen asserts, meant that strong Christian commitments among imperial powers led to harsher punishments for ethical misbehavior. In his words, for pagans, only correct cult mattered. Christian zeal, in contrast, was directed over all of daily life. Hence, threats and torture, the stake and the block, spread over many new categories of offense. Constantine's harsh judgments did not fall only on anonymous inhabitants of his empire. They were felt by his own kin. We have already seen how, upon his accession to power, he had his 10-year-old nephew, the son of his rival Galerius, executed. More shocking still, and the source of considerable puzzlement, were the deaths possibly on his orders of his eldest son, Crispus, and his wife, Fausta. Constantine had 4 sons, the first, Crispus, with Minervina, possibly his concubine, and the other 3 with his wife, Fausta, daughter of the emperor Maximian, whom he had married in 307 CE. As a young man, we are not certain of the year of his birth, Crispus was made a junior emperor, or Caesar. This was in 317 CE. He became an entrusted officer in Constantine's military and played a key role in several armed conflicts, most notably as a leader of the naval forces in the defeat of Licinius in 324 CE. But 2 years later, in July 326, both he and his stepmother died under mysterious circumstances, one after the other. Their deaths were obviously connected. Crispus was either murdered or executed on order of the emperor. Soon thereafter, Fausta suffered a grisly fate, cooked to death in a steam bath overheated for the occasion. Attempts to explain the 2 deaths go back to ancient times. The 6th century pagan historian Zosimus and the 12th century Zonarus both provide salacious details. In the fuller version, Fausta attempted to seduce her stepson, only to be repudiated. In her fury, she accused him of attempted rape, and Constantine had him executed. When he later found the accusation was false, he ordered for her a particularly gruesome execution. Many modern historians doubt the story, but Noel Lenski points out that Constantine did have a highly moralistic streak, see the legislation above, and that he was especially averse to adultery. So Lenski supposes that there may then be a kernel of truth in this pagan version. On the other hand, Timothy Barnes, one of the most prolific and controversial modern scholars of Constantine, has worked out an alternative scenario less sexy, equally speculative, but entirely plausible. He begins by arguing that Crispus was indeed executed on order of the emperor. But since none of our sources reveals the charges, Barnes concludes there must not have been a public trial. It was a private affair carried out by Constantine himself, with only his most trusted advisers present. Fausta, on the other hand, could not have been executed. Emperors, including Constantine, never resorted to massively overheated steam baths for their executions. What then? Barnes considers but rejects the various options, including an even more titillating theory that Crispus and Fausta had in fact consummated a tryst. When she unintentionally became pregnant, he was executed and she attempted to facilitate an abortion through the excessive heat of a steam room, inadvertently dying in the process. But Barnes is not convinced. There is no real evidence for sexual misconduct, and there are other plausible and far more common reasons for an emperor to execute a son who was the future claimant to the throne. Barnes thinks Fausta told Constantine that Crispus was planning a coup, inventing the story so as to remove the heir to the throne and make way for one of her own sons. Constantine responded as tyrants do. He had a son executed. But then Constantine's mother, Helena, informed him of Faustus' insidious plot. Rather than face what would surely be a gruesome execution, Fausta committed suicide in a steam bath. It may not have been the most sensible choice, but frantic people are not always rational. We will never know what really happened or why. It is one of the many puzzling episodes of Constantine's relatively well-documented reign. The death of Constantine. For some historians of antiquity, the most telling aspect of Constantine's final days is his decision to wait until the last minute to be baptized. Would he have done so if he had really been a Christian for 25 years? As we have already seen, however, not only would Christians conceivably delay baptism, they often did so, Constantine's own son, the vigorously Christian Constantius II, who was theologically Arian, did the same thing. The afterlife was much safer for those with no time to commit post-baptismal sins before arriving at the pearly gates, and so they both delayed. Less puzzling is the sequence of events leading up to Constantine's demise. Throughout his long reign, Constantine had to deal with the problems of foreign invasion. In 337 CE, when the Persians began to flex their expansionist muscles in the east, Constantine decided once more to lead his armies to the frontier. Conveniently for his purposes, the march would take him north of Palestine, allowing him to make a detour en route to be baptized in the Jordan River, just like Jesus himself. Constantine knew he was on his last legs. But his legs were not destined to last even that long. Constantine took ill soon after beginning the journey and was forced to stop in Nicomedia in the western part of what is now Turkey. There he called in the bishop of Nicomedia and was baptized on his deathbed. He died on May 22, 337. His sons were to take over the reins of the empire, and the Constantinian dynasty would last to 363 CE. The Christian Emperor Constantine in sum. In summing up the rule of Constantine, it is simplest to begin by again emphasizing what Constantine did not do, contrary to what many people have thought and some scholars have argued. He did not make Christianity the official state religion of the Roman Empire. He almost certainly would not have objected to doing so had he been in a position to make it happen, but that was not the case. If our numbers are correct, no more than 4 million of the empire's 60 million inhabitants shared his religious preference when he himself converted to the Christian faith. He was vastly outnumbered, and it probably never occurred to him to legislate Christianity for all his subjects. On the contrary, Constantine had no mission to convert the masses of pagans who continued to follow traditional religious practices. He remained remarkably open to those of other persuasions, especially to those who, like his father, embraced some kind of pagan henotheism. He was content to practice Christianity himself, to support and promote the activities of the church, to intervene in ecclesiastical affairs when issues of unity arose, to fund the building of churches, and to provide social and economic advantages to Christian clergy. It may have been his duty to be Christian, in some sense, as an emperor, but it was not his duty to prescribe pagan practices, shut down large numbers of temples throughout the empire, or prohibit the practice of sacrifice, even though he personally detested it. During Constantine's reign, Christianity was certainly a favored religion, and it probably did not require extraordinary intelligence for members of the imperial elite to realize that converting to the faith would not hurt their chances for advancement. This was especially true for elites who were then tabbed for official church service, given the economic privileges enjoyed by the Christian clergy. In any event, most of the pressure Constantine applied came through acts of persuasion, either overt or subtle, but not through force. This much we can say about what Constantine did not do. Obviously more important is what he did do. He certainly converted to worship the Christian God alone in 312 CE, in connection with the battle at the Milvian Bridge, even if it took a long time to realize fully what it meant to embrace the Christian faith. Still, this was a genuine conversion. At that point, Constantine dedicated himself to honoring and obeying the God of the Christians. He did not do so with complete success, if being a faithful Christian means loving your enemies and turning the other cheek. Then again, he was not the sort of figure Jesus would have envisioned while preaching in rural Galilee. Constantine was an emperor with enormous burdens and responsibilities. Harsh legislation and the occasional ruthless act were all part of the job. Possibly the most important thing Constantine did for the future of the religion is that he saw that his sons were raised in the Christian tradition in preparation for what was to come next. The tetrarchic experiment of Diocletian had died nearly as soon as its policy of meritorious succession was carried out. Constantine returned to the dynastic principle that emperors had regularly followed, or tried to follow, since the early days of the empire. In his case, that meant succession would come to Christians. With the exception of the 19-month reign of Constantine's nephew Julian in 361 to 363 CE, every remaining Roman emperor was Christian. Constantine also set an important precedent in his decision to intervene in ecclesiastical affairs. His intervention makes perfect sense in a Roman imperial context. All of Constantine's predecessors had been the chief priest, the Pontifex Maximus, of the religions of Rome, as was he, despite the fact he was a Christian. The Roman emperor, like the Roman state, was not removed from the religious sphere, but was at the very center of it. And so even though he was a complete neophyte, a theological child, Constantine thrust himself into matters of Christian polity and theology. A unified church was important for a unified empire, and a disunified church, or at least parts of it, obviously failed to carry out the will of the God overall. That could lead to disaster. Constantine entered into the fray with what might look like wild and naive abandon, but his decision to do so makes sense, both politically and theologically. These interventions may have seemed good and natural at the time, but they were to have a domino effect in the years and decades to come. If emperors actively dictated the direction of religion in the empire and of the church in particular, what might happen when the Roman world experienced a sea change, when the Christians overtook the pagan majority, and when there was no longer any real fear of massive uprisings or reprisals against the Christian cause? What might happen should emperors more aggressive than Constantine arise, rulers with no qualms about using the power of state to promote the purposes of faith? It was almost bound to happen. By the end of the 4th century, the first Christian emperor's decision to prefer persuasion to coercion had become a thing of the past. Christianity was declared the state religion. Traditional pagan practices were proscribed, temples were leveled, and sacred cult objects and art were destroyed. Chapter 9. Conversion and Coercion, the Beginnings of a Christian Empire. The most significant Christianization of the Roman world occurred throughout the course of the 4th century. The massive conversions over this period, as the church grew from 2 or 3 million to something like 30 million, do not mean that the rate of Christian growth increased. On the contrary, it slowed considerably. That is the miracle of an exponential curve. Once the raw numbers start to increase, they snowball. One major reason the rate of growth must have decreased is that new additions to the faith left fewer persons to convert. Still, even as the rate of conversion slowed, the ease of conversion increased. It became easier and easier to become a Christian. With Constantine, the persecutions had ended. No longer was conversion dangerous to life and limb. On the contrary, the emperor himself claimed allegiance to the church. More people were joining the Christian ranks daily. Church buildings were being constructed. Members of the elite were starting to convert. A shift of religious commitments could be so propitious that we have records of fake conversions. The biographer of Constantine, the church father Eusebius, mentions people who converted in order to take advantage of the benefactions coming to the Christians from the emperor himself. The pagan orator Libanius maintains that coercive means of conversion led to phantom Christians. If the Christians tell you that some other people have been converted by such forceful measures and now share their religious beliefs, do not overlook the fact that they speak of conversions apparent, not real. Their converts have not really been changed. They only say they have. The Bishop of Milan, Ambrose, mentions pagans who converted to raise their stock with Christian women with whom they had a love interest. The bulk of the conversions, however, were certainly real. Most people turned to the Christian faith because they had become convinced of its message and looked forward to the divine benefits that could be provided by the Christian God. Once a family converted, the children would be raised Christian, and at that point, just in familial terms, no conversions were needed. That was true of most of the imperial families, who came in the wake of Constantine, beginning with his own sons and heirs. They were Christian from infancy. Emperors after Constantine, with the one exception of his nephew Julian, publicly declared their commitment to the Christian God, promoted the Christian religion, and with increasing frequency, openly opposed traditional pagan cults with their practices of sacrifice. But there was no one moment when the world stopped being pagan to become Christian, no single breaking point. Most of the inhabitants of the empire did not perceive that they were in the midst of a momentous shift or that anything like a life-and-death struggle, a fight to the finish for the soul of paganism, was occurring around them. Most people were pagan up until the end of the 4th century, and many continued to be pagan well beyond that. For the majority of the population, theological questions and religious allegiances were probably not overwhelmingly important, even if they did matter a great deal to a number of people in power, all the way up to the emperor. Even among these powerful elites, one could find a large range of religious commitments, both pagan and Christian. As historian of late antiquity Peter Brown has argued, even into the 390s, polytheism, in fact, remained prevalent on all levels of East Roman society. Indeed, if pagans kept to themselves, they were for the most part left alone, unmolested, despite the legislation issued against their practices and the occasional acts of violence that occurred. But legislation did appear, and violence did sometimes raise its ugly head as the shift from pagan to Christian occurred, especially in the high reaches of government, with the emergence of Christian emperors far more vocal and forceful in their religious views than Constantine had been. The sons of Constantine. Constantine's father, Constantius, became Caesar of the West in 293 CE, and then Senior Augustus in the Imperial College with the abdication of Maximian in 305 CE. His dynasty was to last 70 years, until the death of Constantine's nephew Julian in 363 CE. It was not a peaceful and closely knit family, as seen nowhere more clearly than in the vicious bloodbath that occurred after Constantine's death on May 22nd, 337, with the event known as the Massacre of the Princes. Constantine's three remaining sons, Constantius II, Constans, and Constantine II, the eldest Crispus having been executed earlier, were to divide his empire among themselves. But there were 11 other male relatives who could in theory have a stake in the succession, and for that reason could be seen as a threat to those already in power. Almost immediately upon the emperor's death, 9 of these were summarily murdered in cold blood, all except 2 young boys, Gallus and Julian, Constantine's nephews. Later in life, Julian named Constantius II as the culprit for the slaughter, and he was probably right. Constantius II was the first son to arrive in Constantinople after Constantine's death, and he had command of the military who carried out the executions. With no rivals, the three sons then divided the empire among themselves, with Constans ruling over Italy, North Africa, and Illyricum, Constantine II over Gaul, Spain, and Britain, and Constantius II over Thrace and the eastern provinces. The three did not rule harmoniously, In 340 CE, Constantine II attempted to wrest Italy from the control of his younger brother Constans, but died in battle. A decade later, in 350 CE, Constans himself was murdered by a usurper. After putting down the usurper, Constantius II then survived as sole ruler. 4 years earlier, Constantius II had elevated his cousin Gallus to the rank of Caesar, but in 354, he had him executed because of a suspected coup. And so, just 17 years after Constantine's death, of the 14 male relatives alive at the time, only two remained, the emperor and his young cousin Julian. All this lust for power and loss of life may make the post-Constantinian imperial court look somewhat less than Christian, but imperial support for the church grew as the blood flowed. Constantius II himself became an outspoken and even vehement proponent of the Christian tradition. Unlike his father, he was committed to the theological views of the Arians that had been denounced at the Council of Nicaea. Numerous internecine Christian controversies occurred during his reign, but more important for our purposes is the heightened anti-paganism. Constantius II ordered pagan temples closed and sacrificial practices stopped. We have already seen a law issued in 341 CE. Superstition shall cease. The madness of sacrifices shall be abolished in accordance with the law of the sainted emperor our father. Anyone who performs sacrifices shall suffer the infliction of a suitable punishment and the effect of an immediate sentence. In a law of 346 CE, the penalties are specified. Temples in all places and in all cities are to be immediately closed and access to them forbidden. No one may perform a sacrifice. Anyone who does shall be struck down with the avenging sword, and his property shall be confiscated. Any governor who fails to avenge such crimes shall be similarly punished. And perhaps more drastically, later in Constantius's reign in 356, anyone who sacrifices or worships images shall be executed. These laws were directed to specific locales, not empire-wide, and there existed no state apparatus to ensure they were carried out. As a result, they had but little effect. Paganism continued unchecked in most places, but the laws do show the will of the emperor, and this would not have gone unnoticed. Conversions away from paganism continued apace. There was, however, one major hiccup in the triumphal march of the Christian church. It came after Constantius's death, with the brief rule of his cousin Julian. The last pagan emperor. Julian probably escaped the massacre of the princes because he was just a 6-year-old at the time. Constantius II appears to have seen him as a potential successor to the throne and made him his ward. For the next 18 years, Constantius II kept him out of public view, under careful scrutiny but at arm's length. Much of Julian's young life and virtually all of his education were in isolation. By 355 CE, barbarian invasions into Gaul had become a major problem, but Constantius II himself was occupied in the east, defending the borders from the Persians, so he appointed the completely inexperienced Julian as Caesar to deal with problems in the west. In his later writings, Julian claimed he was granted no real power along with his title, but that appears not to be true. On the contrary, even though completely lacking in military field experience, he did have a good bit of textbook knowledge. Remarkably enough, it appears to have stood him in good stead. Julian had studied the commentaries of Julius Caesar in his military endeavors, and used what he learned to significant effect. By the end of 358 CE, Julian's military prowess was evident to all, including the suspicious Constantius II, who kept a close watch lest his cousin's success in the field should translate into political ambition. The breakdown in relations occurred in 360 CE. Constantius II was experiencing increasing problems with the Persians, while the situation in the west had significantly calmed. He directed his cousin to transfer to him a massive number of troops over a third or possibly even a half of Julian's entire army. Those western troops, many of them from Gaul, were not happy with the order and responded by declaring their own commander, Augustus. It is not clear whether this was a spontaneous or unexpected act, as Julian himself later claimed, or whether he himself had orchestrated it. In either event, since the acclamation became known to Constantius II, The two stood at irreconcilable odds. Civil war was the only option. Julian marched to confront his cousin, but as fate would have it, Constantius II died unexpectedly before he arrived at the age of 44. Julian spent his first 6 months as emperor in Constantinople and then 9 unhappy and turbulent months in Antioch before marching against the Persians. He was killed early in the conflict, having ruled the empire for a mere 19 months. It was an eventful year and a half, however, especially for pagan-Christian relations. Upon ascending to the throne, Julian declared he had converted to paganism years earlier. The very fact that he could understand paganism as a religion to which he could even convert shows just how much it changed by this time. He made it one of his goals to reinstate traditional pagan sacrificial practices throughout the empire. That required him to suppress the burgeoning Christian movement. We do not know why exactly Julian became such a passionate devotee of pagan traditions. We do know that as a studious young man, in addition to reading Christian literature, he devoured the pagan classics and was drawn to the moral world they portrayed. Moreover, his bad experience with Christians may have made the difference. His ardent Christian cousin Constantius II had arranged for the murder of all his male relatives. In some ways, Julian's passionate devotion to the pagan cause was driven by a now familiar motivation. He indicates that the gods say they will give rewards for our labors if we do not grow slack. He certainly was not slack. At the beginning of his reign, he reopened pagan temples, restored pagan rites, and declared universal religious tolerance. More famous than these positive steps to rejuvenate traditional religion were the negative measures he took to strangle Christianity. Julian had no intention of persecuting Christians, imprisoning them, or making them martyrs. He was a good enough student of history to know how badly that would go. But he did rescind many of the benefits afforded Christians by his predecessors and reversed several of their policies. Some of his actions were subtle. For example, his Arian cousin Constantius II had exiled a number of Christian leaders who did not toe the Arian theological line that he preferred. Julian brought them back from exile. This appears not to have been an act of tolerance. On the contrary, it was almost certainly an attempt to weaken the church by reintroducing vehemently opposed spokespersons back into communities that had earlier been rid of them. A disunified Christian movement posed far fewer problems to a pagan resurgence than a unified front. Less subtly, Julian eliminated privileges accorded to Christian clergy since the time of his uncle Constantine. No longer were they exempt from participating in civil life or contributing their wealth to municipal causes. This move satisfied two needs. It weakened the elite clergy by draining a good bit of their resources, and it strengthened the governance of the cities. It also, of course, brought funds from the church into the municipal coffers. Julian sometimes refused to provide justice for Christian leaders. In December 361, an Arian bishop named George was murdered by a pagan mob in Alexandria, Egypt. When Christians howled their objections, Julian chose not to penalize the culprits and explained why. He considered George an enemy of the gods. Julian would not order the death of Christian leaders, but he would not object to them either. Possibly most insidious of all was an edict Julian published on June 17, 362, proscribing Christian instructors from teaching the pagan classics to schoolboys. Julian's logic was that no one should teach what they did not believe. Moreover, Christians were unqualified to teach the classics, because they were themselves morally deficient. Christian teachers were given a choice. They could either acknowledge the gods or resign their positions. This policy may seem relatively benign, but in fact it was unusually clever. No longer could Christians teach the principal subjects of instruction, grammar, rhetoric, and philosophy. That meant the next generation of elites would be trained exclusively by pagans. As ancient historian Glenn Bowersock points out, Julian knew perfectly well what he was doing. Within little more than a generation, the educated elite of the empire would be pagan. In trying to devise steps to increase the attractiveness of the pagan traditions, Julian strove to make changes, particularly in light of what he considered to be the greatest appeal of the Christian tradition, its social programs. Do we not observe that what has most of all fostered the growth of atheism, i.e. Christianity, is humanity toward strangers, forethought in regard to the burial of the dead, and an affectation of dignity in one's life. Each of these ought, in my opinion, to be cultivated genuinely by us. To provide pagan counterparts, Julian set up guest houses in cities and free distribution of wheat